it's very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's been quite a while since I came, so it's nice to see old friends and new. And I just really want to express my appreciation to everybody. To keep something like this going, you know, week after week, year after year, it's really a great thing, you know, and because real Zen practice, it seems to be, can only function within the context of a healthy community. That seems to be the case. You know, you can try to take these things up on your own and it has some value, but it seems like to really transform your heart through practice really requires community. And so everybody who comes, and you know, the hardcore people who always come, and the people who come once in a while, and the people who just you know, like call to say I can't come this week, you know, everybody contributes to that. So thank you for your efforts. It's great. And I want to tell you that I should introduce myself maybe. So I'm Noman Tim Burnett from Bellingham, and we have a community in the same style there in a Zendo. I want to make sure you feel invited to come up. It's the same, pretty much the same gig, a few minor differences obviously, since I just bowed at the wrong time, I guess. But nothing, you know, you'd feel very comfortable and at home, I think, and we'd enjoy having you. And we have a couple of sesshin coming up, too, so you can look on the website, but we have a one-day sesshin in the middle of February and a three-day sesshin at the very beginning of March. At the one in the beginning of March, Norman Fisher will be leading also, so it's nice to get to practice with him. I am an ordained student of him, of Norman, and while I've spent some periods of time in monastic settings, in the different practice center, practice places. Am I speaking loud enough? Okay, in the different practice places of San Francisco Zen Center, I spent some time in monastic settings. But really, most of my training has been just exactly this. Just exactly this. Just showing up week after week and helping to organize and encourage myself and others to keep practicing within this complicated context of all these things we're trying to do, having a job and a family and all these things, you know, a car, you know, these are complicated practices, you know, and sometimes it might sound like to be like a monk in a monastery would be like really hard, you know, you gotta get up early and there's all this zazen, your knees probably fall off, you know, but actually that's easier than this. Because it's quite structured, and you know exactly what you're supposed to be doing at all times. There's a great sort of support and freedom in that life that we have to create for ourselves. You had to decide whether to come down here this morning and work with whatever bit of resistance you might have felt, and just the sort of bare fact of having to make a choice. This is a valuable thing to do. We probably all agree on that, or we wouldn't be here. But there are many other valuable things you could have done this morning, maybe more important than this. And so we all have to make all these choices and balance a complicated life and to figure out how to integrate practice. And you know, I used to think I never was planning to do all this. You know, I moved to Bellingham about 20 years ago, and I just mostly figured I wouldn't be able to keep this up on my own. You know, it just seemed unlikely that I would have the sort of discipline to do meditation practice regularly and study and sort of keep alive that feeling that I had started to cultivate in my practice. So I was just looking for people to practice with so I wouldn't quit, you know what I mean? So I never intended for it to become like a major establishment and to have special outfits and all this. It was not my plan. Because, for one thing, I figured what we could do in these small lay sanghas, I figured, well, that probably wasn't, you know, really complete practice. Then maybe we could introduce people to practice, And maybe we could get started, and maybe we could encourage each other a little bit. But that really, it seemed like to have full-on, transformational, powerful Zen practice, you would probably need a monastery and many priests and teachers and like enormous bells and big, you know, rooms with beautiful dark wood, you know, and lots of, you know, lots of stuff like that. And so I figured what we were doing, you know, what you're doing now, it seemed like maybe it was sort of the beginner version, you know, the sort of baby Zen. Which, you know, makes sense that one would think that. Because we were so focused on the external arrangements and the appearances and surfaces of things. But little by little, over nearly 20 years, I've seen that just this is complete practice. That many serious Zen students in Bellingham have never been to the big centers, maybe never will, have tried to sit at home, have come pretty regularly once a week, twice a week maybe, to the center, have stayed in touch, and have over the years just set their intention, maybe without even really realizing that's what they're doing, really just set their intention to be more mindful, to be more kind, to be more aware of what's really happening on this moment, aside from our opinions and ideas and, you know, sufferings and worries and wishes, what's actually happening. So to just steadily set and renew that intention, even without a great Zen monastic establishment, it turns out to be complete practice and very deep and transformational. So I just want to say that by way of encouragement and to report back on the experiment that we've been running now for 19 years in Bellingham and some quite a number of years here too. And in a way, we have a sort of advantage over the great residential practice places, much as we treasure them, and it's wonderful to go visit these places and live there for a while and sort of get that sort of traditional lifestyle in your bones. But in a way, we have a great advantage because we're forced from the get-go to figure out experientially and directly how to integrate this into our actual lives, as I was saying earlier. Because, you know, what's very common for people who are many years in residential practice is when they leave, it's like really traumatic, you know? Because suddenly all that support of the schedule and the routine and the establishment is stripped away and you kind of like don't know what to do. So most of them have this sort of difficult period of integration and sort of rediscovery of what they've been practicing and learning and a sort of shedding away maybe of some of the conceptions they had of separation between the pure life in the monastery and the opposite outside. So us guys are sort of constantly working on that koan, you know, so we've got a great sort of advantage. Much as it's great to go to those places and learn from people who practice many years in residential practice, we have something too to offer. But at the same time, I know this kind of practice life can be a little bit frustrating. Because sometimes it seems like nothing much is happening. Have you noticed that? You seem like the same old messed up you that you were a year ago or 10 years ago. So is it really any good? Is there progress? Is it something that can really change us? Or is our personality and trajectory just too fixed by our conditioning and our family and our society? Is Zen ultimately something that can really work on that? Or is it more just like a hobby? Or like a club? It's a nice club. You meet very nice people. Don't you agree? And it's very pleasant. But then, at whenever it is we walk out the door, noon, 11:30? How long am I supposed to talk for? You got to watch me. I can go on too long. When am I supposed to stop the talk?
Basically, 20 after, I think, would be...
20 after? Oh, okay.
We've all been...
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially with a guest like yourself.
Oh, okay. All right, so you don't mind if I waste a good part of your afternoon? All right, because I'm just getting started, I'm afraid. This is just the introduction to the introduction. Sorry. So anyway, practice is difficult for us that way. There can be a real sense of uncertainty. What are we doing? But that's where having a community really helps us. Because you can't necessarily see in yourself transformation and real change, because you're always right in the middle of it. But you can see it in your Sangha comrades. You can see over the years that they are becoming kinder, warmer, less bent out of shape by the inexorable problems of reality. And you can feel sometimes the sort of magic of Zazen practice welling up in unexpected times, you know, usually like not in the Zendo, right? Other times. A moment when, even though there's no particular reason or rhyme or reason to it, it just seems like, you know, everything actually is okay, just the way it is. And just the fact of sitting down to do meditation practice, whether here in the community or at home, little by little you notice that something always happens. Something always happens. You know, you don't necessarily really understand what happened or what's happening. But something always shifts. And luckily, it is not dependent on your inner judgments and opinions about how Zazen is going. Zazen always functions, somehow. Whether you're distracted and confused and upset about something and obsessively thinking about something, it functions. If you're calm, relaxed, aware of your wonder, the wonder of breathing, you know, all that, Zazen still functions. So we have these questions as we take up practice and as we continue over the years. And maybe in a way it doesn't matter that much what our opinion is about how it's going. Somehow, if practice touches our heart, we manage to keep showing up and allow it to work on us and get a little bit out of the way. And yet, we have these human problems. We have these yearnings, you know, for a different life, not the life we were given. And once in a while, that's more or less obvious to us. And I was thinking about this because the other night, my wife and I watched a movie. And it happened to be the movie, what's it called? Julie and Julia. Have you seen this movie? I won't spend up our 20 minutes on what the movie was about, but like all movies, the characters have problems, you know, have things to work through, have relationships, and somehow we always have complete confidence over the course of the movie that it's going to work out. There's no doubt in our mind. They're going to rise to the occasion, they're going to find the support they need, and it will end in the last moments of the movie with a beautiful moment when everything is just right in the lives of the characters. When the love that all the others feel for them is expressed so perfectly, and the music swells, and life is perfect. And so I was thinking, you know, we are deeply conditioned to want a life which is basically a movie. We know that there's going to be some struggles and some trouble, but we would like the assurance, as in the movies, that it will always work out in the end. And then we were looking on the DVD, you know, and they have the extras, right? And in this case, we were kind of curious, do they have like any sort of more information about what Julia Child really was about and all this? Because you're always a little dubious when you see the movie biopic, like, oh yeah, but what really happened? And they didn't have that much about Julia Child, but they had the featurette. Have you ever seen the featurette on the DVD? I've seen three or four of these, and I've come to realize it's a very particular art form that's emerged in postmodern America. Because in the featurette, it's even better than the movie. What they do, if you haven't seen these, is they show you clips from the movie, essentially summarizing the movie, and then they cut from the clip to short interviews with the people involved in making the movie. And it seems like they kind of go in order of hierarchy. So they start with the producer. And the producer always says, "This was the perfect project. The minute I read that book, I knew this was going to be a great movie and was going to win lots of awards and be perfect." And then they go back and show you another scene. And they cut to the director, and the director says, "We are so lucky to have so-and-so as the star," Meryl Streep in this case. "She was so well prepared, such a wonderful professional. It was the best thing ever to work with Meryl Streep." And they cut back to the movie. And then they get to go to the star, you know, and the star always compliments the co-star and the director and how wonderful it was. And it goes on like this for a long time until eventually you turn it off. You usually can't get to the end. You know, because so it's quite tedious, but also very beautiful. Because in the world of the featurette, there are actually no problems at all. Everybody is talented and funny and supportive and just right in their role. They have to make effort, they had to work hard, but there were no problems. It was the best year of their lives. And then I'm realizing, actually, what we really want is the featurette. So how is it that we have developed this idea? That we could somehow trade in this life for a better one. And implied in that idea is that we own something called our life. It's a fairly complicated object, has many aspects of personality and history and tendencies. But basically, we feel like I own something called my life, Tim's life. And it's something that I can manipulate and try to, you know, control to some extent. And if I could just do the right things, I could probably trade it in and get a better one without so many troublesome aspects, just the parts I like, just like in the movies or in the featurette. If you never watched one of these featurettes, you should really watch it. Everything is so perfect. It's amazing. And I don't think they're lying either. I think they just kind of enter into a certain sort of mode of being when they make these things, you know, a certain kind of celebration. And then, through whatever strange karma, we end up taking up meditation practice. And at first, it might be a little bit disturbing to actually sit down, be a little more quiet, and notice the thoughts that arise in the mind with a little more honesty. Because it's a little bit disturbing. Have you noticed what the mind can churn up? There are thoughts of insecurity, jealousy, anger, pride, all kinds of things. It's a little embarrassing too, isn't it? Like sitting next to this very nice person here in the Dojo Zendo, who you know is a nice person, has nothing against you, and you find yourself just like, why is he sitting like that? Why do you do that? Or whatever it is. Or he thinks he's so good, or she's so good. And so as we look at the mind, we find that the thoughts in the mind are often out of balance, out of whack. And we also notice in the Zendo and beyond that the mind has a tremendous ability to invent untrue stories about reality. For me, this is often particularly noticeable about other people. That based on very scanty evidence, the mind can generate a very complicated story about another person. The color of their skin, the way they walk, what they say, the accent of their voice, what they did or didn't do that you thought they should have. And then inevitably these stories are not really correct. And And so it's a little disconcerting to investigate the mind. Then you really want to trade in the self. And so practice could easily become a kind of attempt to escape. Maybe there's a way that I can fix this and escape these problems. Maybe I could become a sort of a Zen person. Someone calmer and more gentle and loving who does not have these thoughts, or at least is much better at hiding them than I am. But that doesn't sound quite right, does it? It doesn't seem like a workable plan to try to escape who we are, or trade in who we are, or try to be some other person. So maybe there's a way that we can engage this idea of who we are in a new way, so that these emanations of mind and body and history are not so troublesome. And so Jeff mentioned that you've been studying Bodhidharma and other great early Zen masters of mythical 6th century China. And so I was looking up the stories about Bodhidharma and his student Weka. And thinking about, well, what did these guys do about this problem of having a mind? Because the circumstances might have been a little different, but I think basically it's the same problem to be a human being in 6th century China as it is in 21st century America. And reading these stories, you're struck by a few things. And the first thing you're struck by is how deeply committed to their practice these guys are. And they are, unfortunately, all guys. We're working on discovering what the history of women in Zen was. But our mainline Zen mythology is all pretty much male, so sorry about that. But it's what we got. But these guys were very committed, sort of insanely off the scale in their commitment and dedication to practice. For them, practice was really the only thing. So maybe you know some of these stories, that when Weka showed up at Bodhidharma's place, after already having practiced for many years, you know, already an established practitioner, we would be glad to have Weka come be our teacher before he met Bodhidharma, you know. He showed up and Bodhidharma wouldn't talk to him, right? And so Weka stood, and it was December in northern China, like a little in the mountains a little bit too, pretty cold. And so Weka just stood there, you know, you can imagine him, very still. Shashu posture. And it started snowing, right? So he didn't move all night. Pretty soon he's buried in snow up to his waist, right? Still sitting there, standing there, very committed. And then it gets worse, because then Bodhidharma consents to ask him to talk to him. Said, well, why are you standing there? And Weka essentially says, I'd like you please to teach me the way. And Bodhidharma tells him, you don't have the capacity for that. You know, I don't think you're that serious. You know, so they're very committed, you know. And then, of course, it gets gory. And this part we don't literally believe, I don't think. But then supposedly Weka took a sword, you know, and chopped off his left arm. It says it was his left arm. But there is history in Buddhism of self-mutilation, sadly. I don't think anybody chopped off their arm, because basically you'd bleed to death without the emergency room. But people did hurt themselves as an expression of their seriousness. So very serious. But then the other thing that you're struck by studying these stories of early Zen masters is how intimate they were with each other, how closely they practiced together for many years. And although it's expressed in sort of extreme Zen language that's further sort of filtered by translation, how much they loved each other and how passionately they expressed their love and concern for each other. Sometimes, you know, expressed as like whacking each other with sticks, but it's all sort of style, you know. It's a somewhat theatrical style. But I want to share with you a few teachings that Bodhidharma gave to Waco, because they're very practical for us. This is after they've been practicing together for 8 years, it says. Once Waco asked Bodhidharma, "Can I hear about the seal of truth of the Buddhas?" Which is kind of a gutsy question, too. Like the other thing you notice is they're very brave. You know, wouldn't you be a little embarrassed after 8 years of living full-time with the greatest living master to say, "So, what's this about again?" Like, I missed them, you know. Like, I missed the memo. Like, what are we doing? You know? Like, we would probably be embarrassed. So, very brave question, you know, to ask, well, what is the seal of the truth of the Buddhas, you know, for all those years? And Bodhidharma replied, "The seal of truth of the Buddhas is not received from another." The seal of truth of the Buddhas is not received from another. So nobody can give you understanding. Nobody can solve your problems for you. So it's a great relief to read those kind of teachings when you get into the Dharma teaching business, you know. There's nothing you can tell anybody. But of course, there's a lot you can say. So that's one beautiful teaching. So to remember that we are our own teacher. Life is our teacher. There's not somebody else outside of us who knows what we need. And another time, he instructed Waka. And this is like Zazen instruction. This is really good. He said, "Outwardly cease all involvements. Outwardly cease all involvements. Inwardly have no coughing or sighing in the mind. With your mind like a wall, you can enter the way." So, in other words, pay attention to the ways that you're caught. So-called outside, don't be so worried and so overly involved. And of course, this is Zen, so they say it in a very absolute way, right? Cease all involvements, right? But we can understand that to mean look at the ways in which we are involved with the mind, involved with the world, sorry. And can we be involved in a more stable, sane way? And inwardly, have no coughing or sighing in the mind. It's great. And there's another translation says have no grasping in the mind. But this is great, no coughing and sighing. You know what, do you understand that? That sort of sense of... See if you can let that go. That little layer of resistance and complaint that is so prevalent. And in the quiet of the Zendo, sometimes you notice that. Like I understand some of you sat all day to celebrate Enlightenment Day. And maybe after about 2 or 3 or 4 hours of sitting, there can be a little sort of feeling, you know. A little bit of resistance to life as it actually is. So to release yourself from this coughing and sighing, from this grasping and resistance. And with a mind that is clear and stable like a wall, enter the way. And then another time, let's see, where'd this one go? Oh, another time, Waka and Bodhidharma are like climbing up a mountain. And we should probably all do more hiking in our practice. Because these guys, you know, not having cars, they did a lot of walking. You know, sometimes hundreds or thousands of miles from place to place. And they were practicing while they were. So one time, Waka climbed up a few houses peak with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma said, "Where are we going?" Which is a famous Zen question, right? Where are we going? Waka said, "Please go right ahead. That's it." Bodhidharma said, "If you go right ahead, you cannot move a step." And then they said later, hearing this, Waka was greatly enlightened. Where are we going? So where are we going? Where do you think you're going? And do you think if you just took one more step, you might get there? The teacher replies, you try to go straight ahead, you cannot take a step because there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. You are already right where you need to be. So another way of expressing what I was trying to say earlier. The life that we already have, to stand right in the middle of that is our true life. So I think you get a little flavor of the sort of intimacy and practice that they had. You know, a little bit coded in Zen language, but very sweet and beautiful. And then another thing you notice in these stories of these great old masters is their humility and their devotion to helping others. And who knows, maybe this actually happened, but the tradition says that after Bodhidharma died and Weka was trying to carry on the tradition, he didn't like establish a big temple and start registering people for important teachings and so on. He went to the city and just hung around and wandered around teaching. This is famous, sort of Zen approach. It says he spent 30 years practicing this way, hiding his light and just mixing in with the crowd. Sometimes he would go to the wine shops, sometimes to the butcher stalls, which is like a little bit scandalous, wine and meat. Sometimes he would give talks on the street. Sometimes he would work along with the outhouse cleaners. So shoveling shit, in other words. Just being with people. And it says that he practiced with men and women of all stations in life. And someone asked him, "But you are a man of the way. Why are you acting like this? Why aren't you in a lofty sort of temple?" And Weka said, "I'm just working with my mind. And what business is it of yours?" And then the last quality I want to mention, besides devotion, intimacy, and humility, is a strong ability to just accept conditions as they arise. And so in this case, apparently, Weka was giving a talk outside the gates of an important monastery. We don't say which city this is, but we'll assume it's the capital, Chang'an, which had many important monasteries. And China is famous throughout history for great establishment of bureaucracies and hierarchies. And so he was basically stepping out of this hierarchy and giving his talk in front of the gates of a monastery. And meanwhile, the head monk inside the monastery was upset by how many people were listening to Weka and not coming in, not listening to him. And so the head monk slandered Weka to a local official, and the official, fooled by what the monk said, unjustly persecuted Weka. So also being bureaucratic, you have to have the right way and the wrong way, right? So there was official teachings. And so this monk said that Weka was heretical, basically. So you thought that only the Catholics did this, but everybody does this. Everybody has heretics. And Weka submitted without complaint and was executed in the year 593. So, again, a little extreme maybe, but can we just accept what arises? And maybe he could tell in this situation if he just fought and made a fuss, it wouldn't do any good. So, these are all nice stories. I hope I've entertained you a little bit, which is the main purpose of a Dharma talk, actually. But what do we do with all this when we're not feeling so chipper, when we're upset and caught by the world, when we're so convinced of the reality of this sticky self, of the meanness of everything we perceive. That we think, this is my thought. This is me seeing you. The way that we glue me, me, me onto every perception, internal and external. What do we do about that? We don't have Bodhidharma here to encourage us, shake us till we wake up. Well, we just practice. The great genius of Zazen is, I think, its baseline simplicity. Just sit down, settle the body, open the spine and the chest, allow space for breathing, and allow the heart to settle on the heart. Don't think you can figure this out or fix yourself up, but just allow healing to happen. And what's great, it turns out, what's lucky for us, it turns out, about this kind of ego glue that we paint everything with, thinking this is all me, is that the glue is pretty weak. It's not very strong. It's just that we have such a big pot of it, you know. We put it on everything. It seems impenetrable. This screen of thinking and confusion that overtakes us sometimes seems so dense, but it's not. If we can just stop for a moment and allow a thought to just come and go without grasping, without interference, without hooking a whole nother chain of thoughts onto that thought. For a second, we can see like a little gap. There's a little feeling of peace. Or once in a while, a big feeling of peace. But then to run around trying to chase that kind of feeling is just the whole problem all over again. So don't do that. Just return to your practice. Return to your breathing. And also, practice faith. This is my kind of last point about practice, which is I think many of us come into Buddhism, or particularly Zen, thinking that it is a method, and also that it is fortunately free of religion. That it's sort of a scientific and reliable system for working with our mind and heart, in which we can apply X amount of effort over Y amount of years, resulting in Z amount of results. We kind of think that, you have to admit. But it turns out that the human heart and mind is massively more complicated than anything you can just apply a method to. And that things don't sort of proceed, you know, step by step like that. And it turns out that a big part of what allows practice to function is simply having faith in practice itself. Or you could say trust, if faith is activating something for you. Trust in practice. It's just a word. And which is not to mean we should be like sort of robots about it. Maybe after some years you figure out that actually I need to do another kind of practice. That's okay. But if we can show up for practice with a spirit of confidence, trust, and faith, that it will work exactly in the way that it needs to, you are giving it much more room to function. And here's another way to say that. I got a great new metaphor. I'm really excited about this metaphor, which is that I've been working, learning how to do a sort of secular form of meditation called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And I'm working with another Zen student. We're trying to help veterans who are in terrible shape. You know, I'm really glad to be starting to get into this. veterans really need the support of meditation, it turns out. And anyway, the guy I'm working with, a fellow named Kurt Holting, used to be a commercial fisherman. And he shared with us this great real-life metaphor from his life in Alaska on a fishing boat, fishing for salmon. He said one of the things he's learned is to keep his gear in the water. Keep his gear in the water, even when he doesn't feel like it. He said that the way it usually works is you're out there for a few days with your nets out, with your gear in the water, and you don't catch a darn thing. You know, and it's pretty high stakes because it's a short season, right? And you know, it's like a sort of not a very lucrative thing. You have to catch a lot of salmon to do well. And the weather's starting to get bad, and you really want to do is pull up your gear and go into harbor. You know, get a good night's sleep. And they work like 24 hours a day. It's very crazy kind of work. But what he says is, you can't do that. You need to keep your gear in the water through the storm. Because inevitably, if you go into the harbor, the other guys who stay out are going to make a huge catch on the next tide. And that meditation practice is like that too. You really don't know what the fish are doing there in the depths of your life. You don't know what you're going to catch. And so you just patiently, you know, keep your gear in the water. Isn't that a good metaphor? Keep your gear in the water. It's like all metaphors, it has its problems, I suppose, but... Well, maybe a poem would say this better. Why don't I close with a poem, and we'll get on with the schedule, not too terribly late. Because basically, in the Dharma business, we're trying to use a lot of words to describe what can't really be described, you know? Some deep, true feeling of our life. That's beyond words and concepts. So poetry's good, you know, they try to use words in a different way. So this is Love After Love by Derek Walcott. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread. Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored, for another who knows you by heart. So take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you have ignored for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Thank you for listening to all that. And maybe we have another chant, is that right?
Yeah, page 4.
Page 4.
May our intention equally extend to every place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Om Muryo Segan. them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.